Welcome to Disruptive Business, where we celebrate those who change the game. And we get a chance to visit with cutting-edge organizations and the innovative leaders who guide them. In the studio with me this morning is my good buddy and co-host Lee Cantor. How you doing, bud?
I am doing A-OK. I'm fired up about the show. Exciting topic, exciting guests.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. And as we often do here when we launch a brand new show, we don't want to take any risk, Lee. We want to bring back people that we know are going to be interesting and are going to have some good, relevant content to share with our listeners. A little bit later in the program, we're going to have a chance to visit with Clint Crosby with Baker Donaldson, who's no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone. But first up on today's show is our buddy Arnaud Viviers, President, CEO, Grand Poobah of Orchitect. Welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Stone and Lee.
Now, Arnaud, why don't you share a little bit for our listeners exactly what Orchitect's up to?
Well, Orchitect is a technology and services company based here in Atlanta that really helps organizations analyze unstructured data, where we help them categorize, analyze, and in essence search the data.
Now, is that something that is a challenge when you have a lot of data? Like, I would imagine in today's world, we're just accumulating just tons and tons of data at a rate that's probably never been done in the history of the world. And to manage all that data, it just seems overwhelming.
Yes. I think if you try and just consider that there's about 260 billion emails sent every day, I mean, it gives you an idea.
Wow.
Unfortunately, about more than 50% of those is spam. But
but it's good to know that you can carve those out pretty efficiently.
Yeah. So the bottom line is the ESI, or electronically stored information, as we know it, is actually just growing exponentially, and the number they counted by these days is zettabytes, which is, I think it's got 19 zeros or something. So.
Now, what were you doing before you decided that you would take something like this on? What kind of work were you doing at that point?
I've always really been in the technology space. I've had the privilege of working for some of the biggest hardware and software companies in the world. And I would say that in the past 20 years, I've really spent most of my career in the software business. And I was on the other side of actually analyzing structured data, which is really relational databases, data warehousing, digital dashboards, and things like that.
Now, I've heard the term, I think it's called big data, and that means that there's just so much of it out there. Now, is your solution something that helps people kind of sort through it to find what's meaningful? Like, what's the pain that your clients are having, and how does your software solve it?
Well, I mean, the fundamental problem with big data is trying to find information.
Right. It's like a needle in a haystack.
It's worse, yeah. Trying to find, you know, so how do you find relevant information? And the real fundamental problem is that conventional search technology, which is really keyword searching, is not cutting it. It's actually not allowing the people to actually find what they need.
Right.
So this is why we came up with some alternate approaches.
So now, who are the competitors in the marketplace? Is like Google a competitor because they have an algorithm to search?
Google is really restricted primarily to web type searches and not corporate documents as such. So they are and they aren't, kind of thing. It's maybe a little different.
Now, how is yours different, though? Like, can you give us an example that how somebody would utilize this?
Absolutely. I mean, maybe I should just step back just a little bit and say the fundamental difference is really concept search.
Okay.
And concept search is the next kind of generation of search after keyword searching that is really going to allow clients to find more information in their data and actually get unique insights into their data.
So can you give me an example, give me what conventional keyword search would maybe bubble up and then what yours would bubble up differently?
Well, typically, I think some of the studies they've done fairly recently, if you actually use keyword searching, you're only really going to find 20% of the real stuff you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, keyword searching is the gold standard.
And that's very literal, right? So if I'm looking for the word pizza, I'll find the word pizza.
That is correct.
And then yours is a little more...
So let's just talk about concepts and finding things in context,
okay?
Because that's really what concept search does. So
right.
If I talk about court, blah, 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 basketball, you actually understand that context.
Right.
If I go court, blah, 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 bailiff, you actually understand what that context
right.
Context is. So you've actually got different types of courts. And what Concept Search does, it can actually give you that kind of insight into the data.
Now, I remember we went to your office before and you showed us some documents from Enron.
Yes.
And you were able to go through all that. That's all public documents.
Mm-hmm.
And you were able to kind of find interesting connections that if you were, you wouldn't be able to find if you were just searching.
Absolutely.
Just randomly. Like, well, the algorithm or your software bubbled up something totally different than what you would have literally been searching for.
Well, that's exactly the point. And maybe this speaks to our chief scientist, Dr. Herb Reutblatt, that mm-hmm. was really a professor for 28 years and is considered to be the founding father of Concept Search. But he spent 18 years doing research on the biosonars of dolphins and how they actually use their biosonar to do signal processing and try and detect objects and other fish underwater.
Right.
So what he basically did is he took the process and the algorithms that he learned from this research and applied that to text analytics, okay, about how do you actually mathematically find interesting and relevant words in, you know, masses of data, in big data.
Right.
So that's in essence what the software does. And because it's all mathematical, we start finding words, we start finding related words around words, and that's basically how the Concept Search engine works. And because it's obviously all mathematics, it's language agnostic. So right out the box, we can do Chinese, Japanese, Spanish, French.
Because it's just looking for patterns that are popping up. It doesn't matter how they're spelled or what symbols are.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So what's the sweet spot in the market? Because it occurs to me, look, the financial arena, healthcare, the legal, all these folks, they're buried in data. Are all these markets for you guys?
Absolutely, they are. You know, the problem that we have as a small emerging company is we cannot boil the ocean. So
you got to focus.
You got to choose.
I'd like to try, but yeah. So where we've really focused our efforts initially has been in the legal space. Of helping people with document review and actually how they can actually find relevant documents pertaining to litigation.
And then, okay, so they're litigating. So then they, I guess, I've seen on TV, they bring boxes and boxes of
right,
papers,
that's like the
right?
tactic, right? Bury them in the paper.
Absolutely. I mean,
does that happen now electronically? They're giving you just terabytes of data that you have to kind of mill through?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, the ESI, or electronically stored information, has now replaced the boxes and boxes of paper, but ultimately that electronic stored information are pages that need to be reviewed
right.
by armies of attorneys. And this is really getting to the
and that gets expensive because
you can't put an intern on that, right? I mean, that's too much at stake, right?
Well, you know, the irony is that most of the people that are doing this document review are JDs. They're all qualified lawyers, okay?
Wow.
Which means they are incredibly intelligent, smart people working at ridiculously, I don't want to say slave labor rates, but almost.
Our attorney in the room is grinning during this whole conversation.
So the bottom line is, you know, you talk about expensive. Typically, to review a document, it's estimated in a legal first pass review where they've got to look at all the documents. It would cost them about $1.20 a document. And I mean, you know,
like a document or a page?
No, a document.
Uh-huh.
A document is typically consists of between 3 and 5 pages.
Uh-huh.
That's how we categorize it or classify it.
Right. And then so now in your solution, though, it's going to go through your system first and get rid of some of the junk, right?
Well, that's really the whole premise of what we call predictive coding or technology-assisted review. This is this disruptive technology that we spoke about, I think, almost 18 months ago on the show.
Right.
And from 18 months ago, it is really people are really starting to pay attention to what predictive coding is and what it can potentially do for the business. And, you know, the fundamental approach of how it is different, the one approach is if I have a legal pass review, I collect 2 million documents, I need an army of attorneys to look at those documents.
Right.
The Orcatech approach with predictive coding is give me one attorney that is maybe – your smartest guy on the case that doesn't cost $50 an hour or $60 an hour, maybe somebody that costs $500 or $800 or $1,000
right.
an hour.
Right, so okay. you're best-in-class guy.
The best.
You're Clint. You're Clint Crosby. That's who you right. want for this piece.
Thank you, absolutely.
But the bottom line is you need one attorney. I was just telling Clint a story here before we started the show. We recently had a case called Global Aerospace versus Landau Aviation where they had a double blizzard early in 2010. An aircraft hangar collapsed at Dulles Airport and crushed 14 executive jets. So they basically, this thing came to the courts in April. They'd collected 10 million documents that they had to review, which is a lot of documents. So the judge ruled for the first time ever, okay, that they could actually use predictive coding to actually cull the documents down. So once they actually did the culling of the documents, they got it down to about 2 million documents. They sent us 2 million documents. So we do the math. 2 million documents, $1.20. It's real easy to see how much it's going to cost, yes, right?
Right.
So we actually ran the predictive coding. We got an attorney, a senior attorney from a company called Schneider Harrison up in Pittsburgh. He trained the system for 2-3 days. After 3 days, they kicked off the system, and we ran the predictive coding. It ran overnight, and we reduced 2 million documents down to 124,000 documents. And so technically, of the 124,000 documents that were left, it was about 98% responsive, you know, to the case.
Right. And so then how much money would that have saved? That's, you're talking,
well, I mean,
it's millions of dollars.
It's millions of dollars. I mean, we are typically, I mean, on that thing, the way they wrote up the case study, they say they saved almost $2 million just on that single review alone.
Right.
So now you're starting to get these stories. You have some success. You've got people that really appreciate what you're doing. But go back 18 months or maybe even further, and you're first out in the market trying to tell this story. Did you get people looking at you like you were just, you know, had one eye in the middle of your forehead? What was that like in the early days?
I can tell you, you know, if I was talking about armies of lawyers, you know, being replaced by cheaper software, it was not a popular subject with the law firm.
But they're the ones who hire you, though, right?
Well, by and large, the law firms do use us, but our primary target is really the corporations.
Uh-huh.
Because our value proposition really resonates with the corporations, where they have very central repositories of data. We're currently working with a very big regional bank in the area, where they basically have 10,000 legal cases going on, and they have 400 law firms they deal with. Now, if you just start thinking about the complexity of, you know, what this entails, it's just enormous. And every time you actually have a lawsuit, you have to send all the data out. So the real ideal solution is rather for the bank to create a central litigation repository and then give the outside law firms access to the relevant documents.
And then the methodology stays the same, though. You have the big pile of documents. You put the best-in-class person on it for a short period of time to kind of get the right words and the nuances of it, and then you run it through the software again, and then that culls it down to a manageable amount.
You guys got it. I mean, you know, if this radio thing doesn't work out, just, you know, you guys can come and rip this stuff.
So do you really have a better mousetrap for now? And maybe I don't even know how patent stuff works on software. So are you ahead of the market and you've got a better product for now, or are there people right on your heels competing, and are you having to deal with competition?
Well, I think as predictive coding is becoming more prominent, I think Orchitect today is maybe one of the top three firms in the world as far as predictive coding goes. We basically have a different approach to how we do our predictive coding. Our approach is what they call statistical sampling. And all I will say at this stage, without boring you to death, okay, there's a lot of very deep computer science behind the whole thing, and a lot of stuff we do is not easy to replicate.
So tell us a little bit about how you go to market, because maybe it's a non-issue after today because now you're on disruptive business and the phone will ring off the hook. But up till today anyway, I mean, you had to lay out this whole marketing strategy and figure out where you were going to put your energy. How do you even get on the radar of those executives that you need to talk to in these companies, or are they coming to you?
Well, you know, it's been a very difficult task for us to actually try and take a new technology like this to the marketplace. And the way that we've really done it is we have recently taken on an investment, and the investor that in our company has another company that, believe it or not, okay, has attorneys that do legal first pass review.
Nice.
So they basically do legal first pass review for a lot of Fortune 500 companies and for a lot of AmLaw 100 law firms.
Right.
And they have a sales force in North America of about 30 attorneys, JDs, selling this stuff. And the attorneys are located in 15 cities across North America. So we're very hopeful that we're actually going to be leveraging this new sales force to actually try and get the technology out and exposure to a lot of law firms and a lot of corporations.
What was it like at the beginning when you, I guess you met this guy, this genius guy who came up with this idea, And you're like, wow, I can see all these possibilities. So in your head, it was probably crystal clear, right, a few years ago when you first stumbled upon this?
Yeah. I think, you know, what really happened is in 2007, I sat down with some engineers and we actually started writing kind of the next generation of email archiving systems.
Right.
I had been involved in the email archiving systems for the past 10 years, and I looked at all the major competitors in the space, the Symantecs, the Autonomies of the world, and really looked at the code, and all the code had actually been written 15, 20 years ago. So we thought that there was actually a better way that we could actually do this in the future.
Right.
So we started developing the next generation email archiving system, which works on a massively parallel basis. And the way that we actually, once we started building the system, we realized that archiving the data is not the problem. Okay, trying to get it out the archive is
all right,
the problem.
That's the problem.
Okay. And once again, looking at the conventional techniques of actually trying to find the data by using keyword searching and metadata searches and things like that was just proving to be way inadequate in terms of trying to find stuff. And this is where we started looking for some alternate technologies to start doing the searching and finding stuff in the masses of data.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where my former company, Strategic Data Retention, came across Orchitech, and we started having discussions early in 2009. And in April of 2010, we actually acquired Orchitech and then renamed my company, the whole entity, as Orchitech. And then we basically took the Orchitech components and we took our components of the email archiving.
And then kind of merged together.
And we basically have spent the last, you know, 2 and a bit years actually building out all this technology, integrating it, putting it into one combined framework, and that's what we call today the Orchitech Document Decisioning Suite, which really gives you a solution from end to end.
So it's a suite. It's not just one big product. It's a suite with different things to attack different aspects. One thing I remember about, you were talking about, he was kind enough to sit us down and show us some of this stuff.
Right.
And I don't remember the name for it, but I'm going to call it social mapping, where you could see that this one guy in this Enron thing, the sample thing, there was a lot going on with that one guy between two or three different people. And then that says, I think that informed you to say, okay, given that, let's apply this and then go really take a deep dive into what that one guy's been up to. Am I articulating that right?
Yeah, that's pretty good, Stone.
Thank you.
You know, I think what Stone is really talking about here is in the decisioning support suite that we actually have, or decisioning document suite, we have very advanced analytics, and the concept search leads us from being able to find things in concept to actually have powerful visualizations. So let's hypothetically just look at the Enron data set. The concept we were looking for in the Enron data set was Raptor. Now, Raptor, my kids think are, you know, dinosaurs.
Right.
And, you know, the guys at Lockheed Martin think it's an F-22 jet fighter.
Right.
Okay. The guys in my data center thinks it's a hard disk drive. But Raptor, as it turns out, was actually a name that Andy Fastow, who was the CFO of Enron, actually gave to some of the special purpose entities he was creating to actually try and hide the losses occurring within Enron. So if you actually go and search for Raptor in the data set, all of a sudden now we will actually get results returned on Raptor. It'll give you the most relevant results first. Then it'll give you a timeline about when people were talking about Raptor, and then the social network that Stone was referring to about who was talking to who about Raptor. So somebody that's investigating can very, very quickly gain very useful insight into their data. And the whole idea of these advanced analytics are to provide investigators with information so they can make data-driven decisions. So they no longer have to guess, as we guess with keyword searching most of the time, but you can actually have data-driven decisions.
It's exactly what I said.
Right?
But I'm never sending another email again. It's all phone calls with me from now on.
So now you're obviously getting some traction, and now you've had this concept, and now it's actually a reality, and people are using it, and now you're saying, I mean, which is, I would imagine, a huge thing to have the courts kind of bless this as being allowed, right? That's a benchmark, I would imagine, for your firm.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a legal precedent that never existed before.
Right.
And I think that from a lot of conferences that I'm attending recently with some of the chief justices in the country, Judge Peck, Judge Shindlin, that they are basically very accepting of this technology and saying it is definitely worthwhile It's defensible from a legal perspective, and if it's defensible and I can cut out 90% of the noise every time I look at documents, why not?
Exactly. It why seems not? Like a win-win all the way around.
Yeah.
Now, so what happens now? Like, are you still developing? I mean, you keep obviously, I guess the software is always a work in progress, right? You're always trying to make it better and better.
Absolutely. The software is a work in progress. We look at the analytics we currently have. There's so many more things we can actually do. There's, you know, we currently have 3 patents on the technology, that relate to language modeling and quantum clustering. And there's a lot more visualizations we can actually work on right now on actually making this stuff much more useful to clients. And there's massive amounts of reporting that we can still expand around this thing. The software development will still continue for many years. And as our revenues start expanding, we'd obviously try and put a good portion of the revenues back into R&D to keep developing the product and keeping it strong.
So is there a little bit of a checklist or 2 or 3 criteria that if I'm a listener out there and I have an organization or I'm involved in litigation or what have you, that you would say, look, if you're meeting these 3 criteria or failing to meet these 3 criteria, probably makes sense to reach out to an Orcatech. How does a firm know that, hey, we probably ought to be talking to these guys?
Well, I think the first key metric that somebody needs to look at is needs to have a look at what is the percentage that they actually spend on litigation or litigation expense as a percentage of revenue. In some recent articles, last Friday there was an article on Bank of America, Brian Moynihan, and basically what they actually have spent on litigation expense. And the bottom line is that Bank of America have revenues, I think, of about $105 billion. Okay. And their legal expense was almost 4.5% of that number.
Wow.
So, we're talking about $5.4 billion, okay, that
right.
they actually spent on legal expense annually. So the good metric that somebody should look at in a Fortune 500 company or even other companies is anything from 2% to about 4.5% in a bad case scenario of what people would actually spend on litigation expense of their revenue. So the biggest savings right off the bat is obviously document review. So if there's any kind of document review that's going on, okay, we can immediately cut that cost in half at least.
Right, dramatically.
Oh,
dramatically.
Yeah, that's
right.
Huge. So let's not make it hard for them. What's the best way for them to reach out and learn more?
The best way is obviously just to contact us at info@Orcatech, and that's ORCATEC.com. Or they can actually just call in at 770-650-7706.
Man, what a perfect conversation to open up, launch this show, Disruptive
yeah.
Business. Thanks so much for coming back and visiting with us, man.
It's a pleasure, Stone.
So can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely.
Terrific. So next up on Disruptive Business is Mr. Clint Crosby with a firm called Baker Donaldson. Here in the studio, we refer to it as Crosby Baker Donaldson, but that's just inside these walls. Welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me back, guys. I sure appreciate it.
We are delighted to have you. And, you know, we've had conversations about emerging businesses with disruptive technology, so this is not an unfamiliar conversation to us. We've been talking about this stuff for a while now, haven't we?
Absolutely. We've been discussing this a lot. We've met at some events, and this is it's a hot area here in Atlanta. So this is I think a great show. It's a great premise to start off on.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun, this show. And we're going to have you guys come back periodically and get us updated on what you're doing, probably get you to chime in on some of what you're out there seeing. But for those listeners who don't know, Baker Donaldson has what would you call it, a division, some hot shots, some rock stars that are focusing on emerging companies, many of whom candidly have disruptive technology, disruptive things to offer the market, or they wouldn't be emerging in the first place, right?
I mean, absolutely. Here in Atlanta and across the Southeast, you're seeing a ton of, startup companies or emerging companies, as we oftentimes call them, that are coming up with just some amazing ideas. And here in the Atlanta area, with Georgia Tech as the university support, there are so many fabulously intelligent people coming out of that institution that businesses are coming here, especially in the coding space that, Arnold was speaking of. I mean, there's a lot of great coders here, and so some businesses are really, it's a great seed place for business. And you're seeing that in healthcare, you're seeing that in general technology, sales management, and there's some great companies out there. I know we'll see you guys here shortly at Venture Atlanta.
Oh, yeah, that's coming up, right?
So,
you got to come by and help us interview some folks.
I'd be happy to come
by.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Yes, we're sponsoring there, so we've been working on some of the coaching of some of the companies, and it's just it's fantastic. I mean, the ideas are just amazing.
You're coaching some of the companies that are competing and are going to be
absolutely. We were on the selection committee and then on the coaching committee, so we got to kind of see ahead of time. You know, you give them a few rounds, and hopefully you can get them to where they're comfortable up there presenting. It's supposed to be a crowd, I think, over 600 people. So a lot of people haven't had the exposure of being in front of that many folks. But yeah, there's a ton going on in Atlanta, and really what Baker has done is we call it our emerging companies team. It's a practice group for kind of using the term of art in the legal field. But we're focused on these companies that are either startups, they're just kind of a back of the napkin idea, or perhaps they're a little bit further along, but our goal is to get connected with them and do what we can to get them off the ground. And, you know, in some cases that's, starting from an LLC, they don't even have an entity. But in some cases, they may be sophisticated people that this may be their second or third time around the block. And so, but we want to come in and give them, our experience at a really solid value and try and build that relationship and hopefully keep them between the ditches long enough that they can build that company and get it to grow.
Now, can you share a little bit about how you would help a company like Arnaud's protect its idea? Like, they have a great idea, it's disruptive, but they have to put some things in place legally to help them help themselves down the road.
Well, absolutely. And as Arnaud mentioned, they obviously have some pretty sophisticated legal structure with, they did an acquisition and a renaming, and they've got a lot on the business side. And I believe he said three patents that that they've attained on their code. And really, the patent is the key piece of intellectual property that you want to get if you can. I mean, there's some ideas that, it's a great idea, but it may not be protectable. But if you can get a patent, that's certainly the best way to keep folks out of your market space, because you get 20 years from your application, you get an exclusive right to make, use, or sell the invention. So that's the best, comes from the U.S. Constitution. That's the best protection that you can get. And we're able to help folks through that process to, one, look at the invention and see if it is patentable. Again, there's things out there that sometimes you just have to be the, as I call it, the fastest and the bestest to market. there's not anything we can do to put you in the patent and trademark office. But if you do have an invention, and we have, capable patent prosecutors in-house that can take a look at that and get you off the ground. I've got, clients in the, battery technology space. I've got clients that, make things that are barely a widget, but in a lot of cases, you can get those widgets protected.
Is a patent something that I can do myself, or do I really need a lawyer to do?
Like an appendectomy. You can do it yourself, Lee. It's no problem.
In your case, Lee, please hire an attorney.
We would recommend attorneys.
Really? Yeah. I don't know. You're a pretty sharp guy. I think you could pull it off.
We have some people come to us where, patent, there's a provisional and a non-provisional. You see a lot of inventors do file their own provisional and then want us to come fix it, if you will, and make it into a non-provisional. It really is best to consult an attorney on the front end because the prosecution is so technical, and just the analysis after the fact, if you do get into litigation or somebody's battling your patent, you have to be thinking about those issues on the front end when you're drafting the patent. And so that's where really that expertise comes into play. And it's not, patents are not inexpensive, so that's why you do see some people try to do it themselves. But I think from a value proposition, especially if you're a growing company and you're looking to attract investors down the road, be that, angel money or on up to bigger dollars to venture money, that's one of the items on their due diligence checklist. Do you have something that's protectable? If you do, is it protected? And who did you have do the work? Because if you did it yourself, that may give them a little pause for concern.
So here's the mental picture I get, Lee, when I think about this practice team, I think you called it.
Yeah.
That is dedicated to the emerging companies inside this highfalutin law firm over there in that nice building in Atlantic Station, right? Is that where you guys
are? We're in Buckhead, Monarch Plaza.
Okay, really nice building. So you have all of these suited up lawyers, and then you got this one group of renegades running around in the Converse Chuck Taylor All-Stars and blue jeans because they got the Steve Jobs kind of guy coming in. Are you that crew over there? And then you bring in the suits when you got to nail down stuff like the patents?
Mentally, we're that crew. Sometimes they do make us wear ties. So, you know, I must confess. But it really is, you know, it's a different world, right? It's a different world. It's a dynamic feel. I mean, it was I was juggling this morning, had some women that I met with this morning have a startup kind of IT placement company. And so I was at Caribou having coffee with them before I came down here and mentioned the show. They're excited. They want to see the results. But that's what we do. I mean, we're available. We get out there and it's, you know, you meet with the clients, where the clients are, and you answer their questions quickly. You get back to them. I mean, as a startup business, you know, things are happening now. They're happening, it seems like, yesterday. So you can't call your attorney and hope to hear back in a couple of weeks. And right. We understand that. We get that. And so, you know, I've got clients that, you know, a lot of my clients have my cell phone number, and sometimes it does ring after hours. And
You didn't even give us your cell phone number.
Well, there's reasons for that. No, just kidding. But my wife understands, you know, the phone may ring at 11 o'clock, but if it does, there's probably a reason for that. But it is, you know, we like to fancy ourselves a, you know, dynamic group. Group moving around and we're out there in the space. You know, we see you guys at Startup Lounge, we'll see you at Venture Atlanta.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, we want to be out meeting the folks that are doing the work in the field and see how we can help. But I think we don't get to wear blue jeans other than an occasional Friday, but I'll tell our managing shareholder you made that suggestion.
Yeah, tell them we've blessed it
absolutely,
here at Business Radio.
Absolutely.
X. So disruptive business. Do you have someone in your stable that you're allowed to talk about a little bit, a company that you consider to be disruptive? And if so, can you speak to what that's been like trying to help them out?
Probably can't mention any names particularly, but I've got, you know, a lot of clients these days are, tech services where you're doing, sales or modeling or, you know, customer modeling, things of that nature. The big thing these days is data, having that data of, you know, why consumers make purchasing decisions and how they make those decisions and who those people are. And so really what clients are working on is how do you collect that data, and then how do you monetize it? Because you guys will see next week at Venture Atlanta, probably a good half of the companies that we saw that are in the sales space, you know, they're going to have an app. They've got their niche as far as how they're, connecting product with purchasers, you know, be it business to consumer or business to business. But the other half or piece of their revenue model is that data. You know, they want that data, and that data has extraordinary value. The disruptive piece of that and something I had some folks in the office yesterday were talking about that is the privacy component, you know, because you're balancing the privacy with the data and there's some, you know, some tension there and people are starting to read those terms of use a little bit more. And it's, basically they say that, yeah, we gather everything about you and we will sell it all, perhaps except maybe your name and your email address. But it's really... It's extraordinary what can be collected and how it can be harvested and then how it can be used and that value. And there's a lot of folks that are doing those usability studies, those consumer dynamic studies, or it's just their niche in the marketplace, their sales marketplace, and they're using that and they're monetizing it. And it's exciting.
Now, when you're working with these firms, you mentioned that it seems very consultative, right? It's not like they may not even know they have a problem. Like you got to kind of be ahead of them, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, again, the women I was talking to this morning, you know, I kind of told them, you know, a lot of companies I deal with like this one, they've got some documents in place. They've got some agreements in place. They've got things that are percolating. And so I say, hey, you know, send those documents to me. Let me take a look at them. Let me kind of give you my thoughts. Maybe they're great. Maybe they don't have any problem, but maybe there's a severe gap there. I actually have one of my clients have to look at an agreement this afternoon to where they do product development, and part of their model was they're going to own the IP. You know, these inventors are going to bring it to them. They're really going to take it from there, and they're going to own the IP. Problem was, the agreement didn't say that. The agreement was actually
just understood,
completely
implied.
Reversed.
We talked about this.
Yeah, and so it's the whole the oral conversation is not going to control the written contract, and so I've got to revise that when I get back to the office. But it's just things that come up to where you do based on the experience, and I've done a lot of litigation over the years, still do a good bit of that, and in a lot of contract review and document review is to prevent that from happening. I'm sure Arnaud can attest. There's nothing more distracting to a company than litigation, particularly unnecessary litigation, if it can be prevented on the front end. And so my job is to have a company perhaps spend a little bit of money for us to take a look at some documents so that they don't spend a lot of money to litigate those documents years down the road. And so that's what we're trying to do. And most companies get that, give a little something now, we'll work with you on the small side. And then, you don't have to worry about somebody coming after you in 5 years.
So this strikes me as, and maybe I'm a little bit cynical or off the mark, but this sounds to me like a good long-term play for you guys. You get in when people are early, they've got some really strong approach, some disruptive technology, and maybe you don't make much money. I don't know, maybe even lose a little money early on. You're dealing with these guys that are up on stage pitching for money, but some of them are going to make it, and everybody's going to win. Is that the strategy for you guys?
It is. I mean, it's relationship building, and it's planting a lot of seeds and trying to make connections with a lot of companies to either, we can help them grow and hopefully grow with them, down the road.
It's your own version of being a venture capitalist, right?
Absolutely.
You're going to get your home runs in there, and you've done the what do you call the actuarial tables, and you've.
It's a legal form of venture capital. That's a great analogy. But that really is, and it's and the exciting piece is one, we work with these companies, directly to help them grow. The other piece of it is we try and get these companies connected to other folks that can help them. Be they, service providers that they can use, or other companies they can sell to, or simply advisors. If they need somebody that's got some CFO experience just to kind of give them some guidance, hey, most people will give up a lunch and meet for an hour or so and give that benefit. And you can really connect those people together and let them grow a relationship, whether you're involved in it or not. And so it really is. And that's obviously the gratifying piece is, you make those connections and people move forward. But we hope to, we put a lot of seeds in the ground, and we hope that they grow up and we can continue that relationship. And in 20 years, we'll look back and talk about, we knew them when, so to speak.
Now, if somebody wants to learn more, maybe get involved with your firm, your website, and then I'd like to have a little roundtable for a bit.
Hey, it's your show, Lee. We're going to do whatever you want to do. Okay,
appreciate
bud?
That.
Yeah, we're at bakerdonelson.com and the Donelson, DonelSon. And then my email address there is Clint Crosby at bakerdonelson.com. And I'd love to hear from anybody that wants to talk more about the offering.
Right. And you prefer like 11 o'clock at night, you said?
Absolutely. 11 o'clock at night. And I'll give you that cell phone number. Hold a moment.
Now, Arno, when you were starting off, did you have a lot, was a lawyer part of your kind of team of advisors? Or did you kind of first try to build it and then you started to build a team of advisors after?
Lee, I'm sad to report lawyers are always part of the deal. So, I think really what Clint has been talking about is really a role of a trusted advisor.
Right.
As a young entrepreneur starting a company, it's invaluable to have that kind of expertise on tap, at very little cost because he's investing his time.
Uh-huh.
I would really say for the entrepreneurial community in Atlanta and for the greater of North America and even the world at that matter, those kind of relationships are absolutely critical to success because, what Clint was talking about can really help you fast track how to solve a whole lot of business problems. And especially when you're trying to go, like a lot of people start businesses in their basements, how do you go to the next level?
Right.
So, that's really how you do it.
Now, as your company has evolved over the years, as a lawyer, you have regular conversations with your attorney? Or are they?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have one attorney. We have multiple attorneys.
Attorneys.
So we have litigation attorneys. We have patent attorneys. We have business contract attorneys. So we have got all kinds of attorneys that we actually have to deal with.
But when you're saying it, like you have to deal with, is that like kind of a necessary evil? Or do you look at these people as people that are helping you get to where you want to go?
I consider them to be people that can actually help us guide in areas of complexity, because, you know, as Clint will tell you, patent law is very complicated, and it's also very expensive. You know, as is contract law, you know, it's very, very critical that, you know, when you write contracts, you've got to write good contracts, because if you don't, they're going to come back and bite you in the butt. Yeah, so... So you got to be really, really careful about all this stuff when you actually do it. And, you know, once again, you know, when you have a litigation attorney, you want a guy carrying a big stick.
Right.
So.
So I want to hear a little bit more about this coaching that you're doing. Can you give us an example of some of the things that you're telling these folks to do at Venture Atlanta? Or maybe the more appropriate question is telling them, whatever you do, don't do this.
Right. What not to do.
You know, and some of it is the they get a little coaching before they see us, but, you know, you see the listing of slides, and if you're squinting to read, it's like, okay, there's way too much text on there, and it's way too small. You know, you don't want your users focused on that, or your attendees focused on that. But a lot of it is just the pace of the pitch. You know, people can talk too fast, you know, trying to get too much information in, and you know, they're nervous. You know, you're trying to,
right.
If you give them a couple, three dry runs, then they're likely to get up there and hit one out of the park. But it's, and some of them, it's a 6 minute pitch at Venture Atlanta, which
six
is
minutes. Six you're minutes. Trying to raise hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. You got 6 minutes.
Precisely. And some of these folks
and they're nervous.
Oh, very nervous. Yeah.
Imagine that.
And so trying to get them down to crunch it in the time, can be difficult. And the other thing is, you know, a lot of them, you have to show the value proposition. You're trying to get somebody to invest in that company. Where's the value? You know, what's going to incentivize that person? I mean, most of these investors are looking to get back their investment plus a substantial multiple of that. So you kind of got to show them where the cash is.
My aunt said it was a fantastic idea at the family reunion. I explained
absolutely.
It to her in great detail. She said it was wonderful.
There are a lot of those, but not at Venture Atlanta. Those have all been culled out by the time
right.
will see these. But it's some amazing ideas that these folk have that they're putting out there. So I think they were all profiled in the Business Chronicle last week. So hopefully some people saw those, the listing of companies. It's going to be a heck of a pitch. And I guess, yeah, we'll be seeing you guys there as well.
We're going to be there. We're going to do the remote broadcast.
Okay.
We're going to interview the speakers, participants, sponsors.
Right.
And I mean, this has been a big part of your life. You have spent much of your energy, time, and resources in raising money over the last couple of years. Right.
Yeah, and you know, I can quite frankly just tell you it's one of the toughest things. As a matter of fact, I actually was a presenter at Venture Atlanta last year, and so I went through all the pitch coaching and stuff. And I must just say, I thought that the pitch coaching was incredibly valuable, because what they really try and teach you is how to hone your message, get it sharp, get your value proposition down, keep it concise, you know, and short, concise, to the point, how to make it punchy. And so I really think what we do with Venture Atlanta here in Atlanta is amazing, and it is really an incredible forum for entrepreneurs. And I think as the economic situation in the country will start improving, so will the investment funds that they actually, you know, people are making in startup companies will actually start improving. And I think that there will be a lot of angel and venture capital investment that'll be taking place in the next 18 months or so.
Yeah, and Arnaud made a good point earlier talking about you can't boil the ocean, and a lot of that is something you have to coach into these new companies, is you have to pick your market. You can't bite them all off at once. You know, as Arnaud said, they've gone, you know, legal, that made the most sense, and for most of these companies, they've got one piece that makes the most sense. You can't go out and pitch everything all at once, because a sophisticated investor knows that there's no way you can afford to do all that. That it's just not going to happen.
And so is it particularly helpful if you know what you're going to do with the money? Is that a little better than not knowing what you're going to do with the money? Do you coach them through having some sort of at least a little bit of a plan?
For most of the companies, yes, they're you know, taught, coached, it's appropriate to say, I want this amount of money, and this is what we plan to do with it. You know, here's how it's going to contribute to the bottom line, that, you know, we're either, we need more developers, we need to, you know, more marketing, you know, we've got the products ready, but we need to push it out to market, or, you know, we need to do some beta testing with, you know, with an agreed, you know, potential customer. So yeah, you normally want to at least have them put it out there in the information piece. And obviously it's a 6 minute incentive. The desire is to get those potential investors back to their table to talk to those companies. So you know, you can't put it all in 6 minutes, but right. you got to set the hook, and you got to get the investor interested enough to come over and you know track you down in the crowd and talk to you.
Right, you're not going to get a check at the end of 6 minutes. That doesn't
matter. Arno probably did. He's good, man.
No. All I can tell you is there's a lot of good ideas, okay, and there's a lot of people that are very interested. You have to kiss a lot of frogs. There's not a lot of guys that write checks.
Right.
So
that's the lesson. After 3.5 years of raising money, now this is the lesson we get. The bottom line is you got to kiss a lot of frogs.
I'm afraid so.
I think that's probably a noteworthy on wrapping up on, yeah?
Absolutely.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton for Lee Cantor, our producer today, Dana Barrett, and our guest this morning, Clint Crosby, and Arno Viviers, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family, saying we'll see you next week on Disruptive Business.